Welcome back to Liberating the Queen. I hope, and today, you guys, we are doing another Liberating the Queen. So, today, you're probably like, why am I talking right now? Well, my mom probably bought me, but she said I could do the intro. So, today, we're doing, these weren't in my history books, at least. Nor my mom's. And today, this was brought to you by Peppermint Ray by Layla, which is me. And today, who is joining us is my mom.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for having me on Liberating the Queen.
Yeah, so today, I'm the person that's going to say all of this stuff. Okay.
Can I take it now?
So, Mama? No, I thought I was doing everything. Okay, I'm going to do everything, people. And so, thank you, Mom, for joining us. And, okay, let's get started.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining Liberating the Queen, a podcast where we discuss amazing women in history that weren't in mine or Layla's history books. Our goal for 2018
is to do podcasts that weren't in my history books or my mom's so we can hit 1 million people to buy our stuff, our podcast. And you guys, you're going to love it. So get every single one, okay? And our goal is to say a bunch of women for, well, not my goal because she did the first, like, three.
We've done 11. This will be our 11th podcast. Today is November 15th, 2018. As Layla said, this episode is brought to you by Peppermint Bay by Layla on Etsy. Head on over to Etsy and search Peppermint Bay by Layla. Today, we are going to talk about an amazing artist, Edmonia Lewis. The first Black sculptress to gain fame on both sides of the Atlantic, she was part of a group of women sculptors that Henry James called, quote, the white Memorem flock, end quote. Born Mary Edmonia Lewis, she sculpted for British nobles and Bostonians. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow posed for her. She was laid out in the press for her classical bust and depictions of American history.
Hey, you guys, I am 10. Yay!
Thank you for sharing that, Layla. I thought we were going to save it for the end, but that's okay. So when I was researching her, estimates vary on her birth year. She was born in upstate New York and lost both of her parents at a young age. Her father was from the Caribbean and her mother was part Ojibwe. Lewis's early life varies in the research, but the 19th century press provides a gripping narrative of her early years. An early orphan, she was, quote, reared among the Native Americans, unquote. Her mother's side, essentially, and as a child, was nicknamed Wildfire. A brief stint in the abolitionist hotbed of McGrawlville in upstate New York led her to another focal point of an early American progressivism, Oberlin, Ohio, where she began studies at Oberlin College in 1859. In her third year at college, where she studied art, she was accused of poisoning two white female roommates with what is commonly known as Spanish fly. In 1862, Lewis had served them mulled wine, which she had obtained somewhat mysteriously in a dry town and while living in a house of a church deacon, before her classmates set out on a sleigh ride with two gentlemen callers. On the disastrous ride out of Oberlin, the two girls became violently, uncontrollably nauseated. The blame was placed on Lewis. Before her trial, she was dragged to a field and beaten by a white mob. In court, she presented herself in crutches, her collarbone shattered. She was represented at trial by John Mercer Langston, who would go on to become the first African-American elect to public office in the United States and a founding dean of Howard Law School. Langston pointed out that the stomach contents of the girls had never been tested, and Lewis was acquitted. But scandal followed her while at college. She couldn't go anywhere without people whispering, and they did not allow her to re-register for courses in 1863. Today, on the website, the Edmonia Lewis Center for Women and Transgender People at Oberlin, I suppose those quotes, says anti-sexism, anti-classism, anti-racism, anti-imperialism, anti-heterosexualism, and anti-transphobia. On the website, the center notes that Lewis left the school, quote, in part due to harassment. But in actuality, they wouldn't let her re-register because of the scandal in the girls' mulled wine. Once she left school, Lewis set off from Oberlin to Boston. While in Boston, she impressed her artistic aspirations on famed abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison, who arranged for her to be mentored by a local sculptor. Sales of a bust of Robert Gould Shaw she created in 1864 funded a one-way ticket to Rome. In Italy, she created a body of work circumscribed by unusual artistic pro-civility. Unlike any other sculptor at that time, she did not use tradesmen to chisel her work according to instructions, carving instead by hand. Let me explain that for this reason. Fewer examples and duplicates of Lewis's work survive than any other sculptor of that period. She created sculptures inspired by Longfellow's The Song of Hiawatha, by the experiences of freed slaves, and one sculpture, Hagar, the cast-off concubine of Abraham, clasped work thick in hands with her half-bare breasts. In Rome and its environs, Lewis moved in a circle of women sculptures of that era, drawn to Italy by the promise of abundant, expertly quarried marble. Henry James once dismissively described this circle as the white marmoman flock. But it was Lewis's non-white status that figured most prominently in her portrayal in the contemporary press. In 1866 interview, laud her talent while simultaneously noting how she prattles like a child with her crisp hair and thick lips. Another account from that period describes her as a curious and exceptional example of native artistic ability. Richardson suggests that this portrayal in the press was not incidental. Not only did Lewis sometimes benefit from the exaggerated exoticism of her portrayal, the notion that she had emerged whole like Aphrodite from the sea of ignorance allowed her to obscure any scandal in her past. Quote, she worked both sides of the street depending on her audience and her patrons. She emphasized her blackness or her Native American origins. She was very savvy about how to keep her identity in play. End quote. By the end of the 19th century, however, Lewis's signature neoclassic style had fallen out of favor in the artistic avant-garde, and the center of gravity of contemporary sculpture had shifted from Rome to Paris. By 1901, Lewis's whereabouts were unknown to the public. In response to a query about Lewis, the editor of an art magazine noted, quote, there seems to be no trace of her in Rome, end quote. In fact, she had left the city behind, and whether she ceased to court the press or the press ceased to court her, her prior fame faded almost completely. No trace was known of her last years in Rome or elsewhere for over a century, and the place of her burial was unknown. Perhaps one of the most well-known among people who know and understand a lot about Edmonia Lewis's history is Marilyn Richardson. She's a retired professor. Richardson began researching Lewis in the 1980s and has pursued the elusive artist for half a lifetime from Boston to Rome, London, and beyond. Richardson, however, never ceased looking, and digitized records worldwide enabled decades of research to really bear fruit. So as part of her death, and a lot of her legacy is really carried on because of the persistence of Richardson. So even if Marilyn Richardson isn't a world-renowned artist like Imona Lewis, she still captures a special place in my heart and a special place in this podcast as a seeker of truth and a seeker of bringing to life. A 1901 census record revealed to Richardson that Imona Lewis had relocated from Rome to London, and subsequent research with the aid of UK lawyer Scott Varland uncovered Lewis's will and burial records. Lewis had died in Hammersmith Infirmary in London of Bright's disease, a chronic and excruciating kidney ailment. From there, she had been taken to the cemetery at Harrow Road. Richardson sees her research as part and parcel with the efforts of other Black women scholars. After all, she noted, Alice Walker found Zora Neale Hurston's grave, quote, out in long grass. So I've become a cemetery sleuth, end quote, she said wearily. In her will, Lewis identified herself as a spinster and sculptor. She asked for a dark walnut coffin and a notice of her death be printed in the Tablet, a British Roman Catholic publication. The resulting announcement, a curt sentence fragment, made no mention of her accomplishments and did not reach those who sought her across the sea until over a century later it found Richardson. This is not the first major discovery Richardson has made over the course of her research into Lewis's life and work. In 1988, she was instrumental in restoring Lewis's most famous work to the public eye. In the 1980s, Richardson explained scholars focused on two of Lewis's work in particular, a 1867 group called Forever Free, housed at Howard University, which depicted a Black man and woman in marble holding up their broken chains, and The Death of Cleopatra, a mammoth composition of Cleopatra's last moments, which had featured in many contemporary accounts of the Philadelphia Exposition, but whose whereabouts were unknown. In 1988, Frank Orland, a dentist from the Forest Park neighborhood of Chicago, wrote into the Metropolitan Museum inquiring about the artist Imona Lewis. He had a piece of work by her, he said, and described it. An enterprising curator forwarded the letter to Richardson, who had put out a query in the New York Times Book Review asking after Lewis. When Orland dodged her repeated calls, she hopped on a plane to O'Hare. When she tracked down the dentist at his home address, she's quoted as saying, "I was willing to camp out in front of his steps if he wasn't going to cooperate," end quote. Richardson had a deep passion for Imona. And fortunately, when she had got there, his wife was home. And she agreed to lead her to the statue. In the storage area of a nearby shopping mall to which Orland had the key, Richardson saw the lost work for the first time. Quote, "It was just standing there in a storage area, surrounded by holiday decorations and papier-mâché turkeys and Christmas lights and Christmas elves." She describes herself as really shaking, end quote. Richardson teamed up with legendary librarian and bibliographer Dorothy Porter, and together they contacted the Smithsonian Museum and the Art Institute of Chicago. After comprehensive restoration, the statue now stands in the Smithsonian American Art Museum Luce Foundation Center, where Cleopatra's unblemished face turns up perpetually towards the vaulted ceiling. Earlier in that summer, Richardson said she ran into a colleague familiar with her long research for the lost years of Imona Lewis. And she was quoted as saying, "Finally, I was able to say I've buried her," end quote. All that's really missing is a plaque. on the green cross-studded grounds of St. Mary's Roman Catholic Cemetery in London. Grave C350 is covered with a moss-pocketed slab of stone bare of any writing. The granite rectangle is nearly flush with the earth. Parish records confirm that underneath it lies the bones of Edmonia Lewis, American sculptor, who was buried there for a fee of £5 and 52 pence in 1907. Lewis, in her lifetime, was an amazing singular figure, a marker of art in pristine marble. Though highly educated, she allowed the contemporary press to portray her as less than. Though black and female, she succeeded in exhibiting her sculptures alongside the upper crust of both sides of the Atlantic. Karen Lemmy, curator of sculptures at the Smithsonian Museum, which owns several pieces of Lewis's work, said, quote, "No matter what frame you put around her, she was unique and succeeded against the odds. But there is this kind of vagueness of the details of her life," end quote. And I think as someone who sat down and did the research on her, I can agree there is a lot of vagueness. But someone with the background of Caribbean and Native American and becoming a sculptor, artist, and traveling the world, I think is pretty awesome in itself. So, Layla, one of your favorite things to do is to play with clay. And your latest work of
slime.
Slime is another big one for you. Your latest work you made out of clay was can you remind me?
Mermaid.
That's right. Did you think it was hard? Because we had a bunch of tools and stuff like that, but did you think it was hard to mold the clay and build like the mermaid tail and stuff?
It was hard, but you helped me.
I did. Could you imagine if we took a brick out of the, you know, we have that paver walkway. If we took a brick out of there and you had to chisel a mermaid, could you imagine that?
Yes. It was so hard.
Do you think that would be hard?
Yeah.
Would you prefer to work with clay or work with a chiseler?
Work with clay.
Because that's what Edmonia Lewis did. She actually chiseled all of her sculptures.
But the thing is, I've already done it before, so it would be easier, right?
Well, maybe. I still think it's pretty hard to chisel.
Well, no, I want to do the clay.
Okay. Yes, you can do the clay.
Okay. Bye.
Well, thank you all for joining us today. Again, please take a look at all of our other episodes. This episode is brought to you by
Peppermint Bay by Layla.
Head on over to Etsy and Google Peppermint Bay by Layla.
And you guys, since I did the beginning and I was the one that's supposed to say everything, I get to end it. So thank you guys so much. I really like you guys. You guys are so nice to watch Liberating the Queen. Definitely buy some Flippenberg gloves and follow the one tower thing. Like
Radio Tower Digital.
Yeah.
That's a great call out, Layla. Thank you.
Digital, because this might be our last one, but it's our last one for 2018, maybe. I don't know, but bye!
Thank you, everyone.